Good morning and welcome to episode 27 of our monthly Meet the Experts Q&A sessions with Cintas employment team. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing at Cintas. Just wanted to take the opportunity just to once again thank you so much for tuning into these sessions, for signing up to them, for sending any questions and for watching the video and afterwards, and also listening to the podcast. We don't take it for granted, so thank you for that. As with previous months, as with previous sessions, our employment team are going to answer three questions, and our speakers today are on the screen in front of you, Associates Catherine Hope and Fiona Campbell. Catherine is going to go first. Questions that we're going to cover today are in front of you. So without any further ado, Catherine, good morning and over to you.
Good morning. Thanks, David. And good morning and thanks for joining us. So the first of the questions we had this morning is about settlement agreements, and it's asking what are the requirements and the considerations for employers when considering settlement agreements. Now, as many of you will of course know, settlement agreements are the only way in which you can get an employee to agree to waive their right to bring certain statutory claims, such as common ones such as unfair dismissal and various discrimination claims, unlawful deduction of wages. And that's why there are certain formalities that it has to follow, and it's really important that you make sure that you're following those so that the document actually does what you need it to do and it gives you that waiver, that protection from those types of claims. It's usually something that you tend to come across when you're looking at the termination of an employee's employment, and it tends to be used when there's been a mutual agreement to terminate for someone to exit the organisation. But it is something that can be used for claims that can be brought during someone's employment. It's just you tend to come about when it's dealing with someone's termination, and that's what I'll look at in terms of considerations today. There's a couple of things to think about when we talk about requirements. There are certain statutory requirements that apply to settlement agreements, so I'll look at those, but I'll also then look at some considerations in terms of the kind of things employers should think about including in a settlement agreement, and that would form the best the basis of the negotiations that lead up to agreeing those terms. So from a statutory perspective, there are certain things that a settlement agreement must comply with, and those are that it must be in writing. It must relate to particular complaints. It can't just be a blanket waiver of all claims. It has to relate to certain complaints, and those need to be set out in the agreement. The employee who's signing up to it needs to receive independent legal advice from a relevant legal advisor, and you need to make sure that the advisor meets the requirements in that regard. That advisor needs to have insurance in place that covers the advice that they are giving, and the agreement needs to identify that legal advisor. And finally, the agreement itself needs to confirm that it's complied with those statutory requirements. So I'd say as an absolute minimum, you need to be making sure that any settlement agreement that you're wanting to enter into with an employee needs to meet those requirements, because if any of those are not met, it's not a legally binding document. So it's not then worth the paper it's written on. So that's just the main thing in terms of the minimum things you need to meet. In terms of considerations for employers, there are a number of things, and it really will depend on the circumstances around why someone is leaving and the type of things you want to think about. But I'd be looking at the arrangements for termination. So is someone going to leave immediately in terms of the termination date? Are they going to work their notice or part of that? Or are you going to want to put them on garden leave? What are the terms of that garden leave? Or do you need them because of their role and then, you know, the importance, or, you know, it might be some urgent things, or in terms of who's taking that role over, do you need a certain period of time where they're going to agree to carry out a handover? So that should be documented in the agreement, so it's clear between the parties what the arrangements are. Payments. You need to obviously set out what the payments are going to be. And again, that will depend on the circumstances. Are you paying them in lieu of their notice entitlement, which will be subject to tax and national insurance? Are they getting that and then a termination payment? And you can pay up to that £30,000 tax-free in terms of compensation for the loss of employment. It may be that they're getting some forms of redundancy payments, whether that be statutory and or enhanced. In other situations where settlement agreements are used, whether, you know, in a corporate transaction, the considerations, the payment that's being made may be nominal, such as a pound. So it all depends on what the circumstances are. You also want to make it really clear that if you're paying an enhanced payment, that is conditional upon the employee complying with the terms of the agreement. So making that clear. And the payment dates, when you as an organisation are going to be able to pay them, that might need to be in instalments, or it could be all in one lump sum. So those are considerations in terms of payments. the waiver, so that what the employee is agreeing to waive in terms of the claims. You should really think about what's relevant to the particular situation. It's also important to note that there are some exclusions, including obviously the employee's ability to enforce the terms if you don't pay them what you're agreeing to, and things such as accrued pension entitlements, they're not affected at all. It's also important to note and to take advice on there are certain claims that can't be settled legally under a settlement agreement. I'd also think about warranties, so certain promises that you're getting the employee to make. Things I'd be looking at there are in terms of warranties relating to them agreeing to return property by a certain date, any company property they still maintain, erasing information belongs to the company they might hold on their own device. Promises in terms of having and obtaining new employment. If you're giving someone a substantial amount of money by way of compensation because there's a real risk of them bringing a tribunal claim and getting a certain amount of compensation, you'll want to know that they haven't obtained new employment, because that will obviously affect the risk and what you could be liable for. So again, this depends on the circumstances. You may want a clause in there saying that, you know, at the point of signing, they haven't already obtained new employment, which would affect any potential liability. Also, in terms of a normal warranty that you would expect to get, is that they're agreeing that they've not done something that could amount to, for example, gross misconduct, gross negligence, so what's referred to as a repudiatory breach of contract, something that would entitle you to sack them without notice. You'd want to know about that. So that's a standard warranty, again, that you'd want to have in there. Indemnities as well, for example, if they did go and bring a claim, that they're covering you in terms of your costs of defending that and any compensation that's awarded, and agreeing to obviously to pay back what you paid them by way of termination payments as debts, covering those kind of things. Also, restrictive covenants. If you are dealing with an employee who doesn't already have restrictive covenants in their contract, it's an opportunity for you to ask them to enter into new ones at the point of signing the settlement agreement. If you're going down that route, there are important considerations in terms of consideration you need to give, so a financial incentive. That could normally be a nominal fee, but it's important to note that those kind of payments are taxable, so you would want to make sure that's separated out in the contract, and it's made clear that that's being paid as consideration for that, so that it's not, tax isn't then applied to the termination payment. Also, restrictions in terms of confidentiality, again, you tend to include things like that, covering and protecting your confidential information as an employer, but also agreeing between the parties as to not disclosing the existence of the agreement and its contents, but making it clear as to who you can speak to and in what circumstances and what can actually be said. So it's clear what the rights and obligations are in that regard. Making it clear if someone has got those kind of provisions already in their contract that you're expecting those and they're acknowledging that they will survive termination. So if you've got restrictive covenants, confidentiality obligations in their employment contracts that survive termination, you're reminding them that those will continue to apply. Making it clear that it does include everything that you're agreeing, so with that entire agreement clause, again, to make sure there's nothing that could be raised in terms of things that have been discussed during negotiations that aren't part of the agreement. That's why it's important to refer to particular clauses that might be surviving termination that are already in their contract. Making reference to the advisor certificate, as I said earlier, you have to identify the legal advisor in the agreement, but from an employer's perspective, you'd always want that evidence that they've seen the advisor, so you'd have an advisor certificate ready for their advisor to complete and to provide to you, so you've got that hard evidence that requirement has been complied with. Just finally, in terms of some points to be ready for that employee may raise if they aren't already covered in a settlement agreement, provision of agreed reference wording so that they know they're going to get something and you're agreeing to provide that. They also might want certain an agreement reached in terms of what the announcement's going to be to other staff members about their departure from the organisation. So you might want to be ready with those, or be ready for that to be raised by the employee once they've taken advice. That's a number of things to consider. So what I would say is, if you have got settlement agreements you've used in the past or you're starting from scratch, do seek legal advice just to make sure that those requirements are met, so that at least what you've got is legally enforceable and you're getting that closure, that protection in terms of what you're then paying the employee for. That's question one. So I'll pass you over to Fiona for the next question.
Thanks, Catherine. Good morning and thanks for tuning in today. So the first question I'm going to look at is, how should an employer approach flexible working requests by an employee? So at the moment, this is rather an interesting question because the government has announced in a recent consultation that changes are going to be made to how employers approach flexible working. So therefore, when you're considering my answer, please be mindful that this relates to the current guidance and things are going to change once the developments are implemented. We will, of course, keep you posted on this. So flexible working isn't just working from home, which now would more commonly be referred to as agile working. It can also include reducing hours to part-time work, changing start and finish times, flexi time, or compressed hours. Equally, it can be for all days, specific days, or even specific weeks. We've had quite a few queries regarding this lately as people return from furlough. Some are happy to get back to their normal full-time roles, but others have enjoyed the balance that extra time at home has given them and have sought to have this more formalised. At present, an employee has a right to make one flexible working request each year, provided they have 26 weeks of continuous service. Essentially, the current guidance sets out that once a request is submitted, the employer must deal with all requests in a reasonable manner, and then they have 3 months to respond to the request, although this can be extended by mutual agreement. So what's meant by reasonable? There's actually no statutory definition of reasonable in the legislation. However, the ACAS code and ACAS guidance have set out best practice for employers, which is discussing the request with the employee as soon as is practicable after receiving the written request. This is advised even when the employer is going to accept the request, as it can help avoid misunderstandings and make sure both parties are clear on the situation. Make sure the employee understands the impact on their terms of employment. For example, if their pay, pension, holidays, etc. are going to be affected, it's helpful to discuss these issues straight away so that the employee is aware of this from the start in case it changes their mind on what they might want. Arrange for meetings to be in private and provide the opportunity for the employee to be accompanied. In terms of actually dealing with the request, employers need to consider the request carefully, looking at the benefits and negative impacts on the business. So once an employer has made their decision, they should notify the employee as soon as possible. However, they need to make sure that this is within 3 months of the date of the request, although, as I mentioned earlier, this can be extended if both parties agree. The outcome is going to be either accepting the request or potentially a compromised version of the request, or rejecting the request because of one or more reasons that I'm going to come on to in a minute. So before accepting or rejecting a request, employers can require a trial period. This might be useful to show the impact it's likely to have on the business and how it would work practically. However, employers need to be mindful that if their intention is to show that this won't work, the opposite could end up being the case, which could then make it a bit more difficult to reject the request. So if the request or the compromised version of the request is going to be accepted, then this change is going to constitute a contractual variation of the employee's employment. It will then continue for the duration of their employment unless it's agreed otherwise by the parties. It's good practice here to issue a new contract setting out the new agreed terms, or alternatively, and what I generally prefer, you can just provide the employee with a letter outlining the amendments and expressly stating which points of the contract are going to change and which will remain the same. This should ideally be signed by the employee to indicate that they've accepted the change. On the other side of that, if there are any further changes, for example, changing back to the original working arrangement, this will again be a contractual variation and so again will require an agreement to do that. Do remember that an employer shouldn't really unilaterally change the contractual terms as it could constitute a breach of contract. Therefore, agreement is generally needed for any change. So if the employer decides to reject a request, as mentioned previously, the only way they can do this is either if the employee isn't actually eligible to make the request in the first place, or if one of the statutory reasons apply. If an employee doesn't have the requisite 26-week service, or if they don't comply with the procedure, then this would allow an employer to refuse a request on the basis that it wasn't eligible. One note here is that even where an employee isn't eligible, to prevent any claims by employees who may have alternative statutory protection, employers should also rely on one or more of the statutory grounds for completeness. Also, the employer needs to be careful about stating that the employee hasn't complied with procedure, as there could be reasons for the non-compliance, which could result in discrimination claims or potentially also a constructive dismissal claim. If employees haven't complied with the procedure, it's sensible to explain the process to the employee so that they can submit a valid request. If it's invalid, it won't count as one request within a 12-month time period, so another request could be submitted at any time. Assuming that the request was eligible and submitted according to the procedure, then, as mentioned, a refusal should be based on one of the 8 reasons specified in the legislation. The reasons are burden of additional costs, impact on quality of services, impact on performance, there being insufficient work at the times that the employee proposes to work, detriment on ability to meet customer demand, being unable to organise work amongst other employees, any structural changes which are proposed, and the request would make the employer unable to recruit additional staff. Whether or not one of these eight reasons applies is a subjective assessment on the part of the employer. The employer only has to consider that this reason applies. It didn't have to prove anything else. Because of the subjectivity of this assessment, it appears that the only challenge to this would be if the facts relied upon for the decision were not correct. Even though there isn't a statutory requirement to include an explanation for the basis of refusal, it might be beneficial for both parties if it was provided, so both parties understand the position. There's no requirement in the legislation to allow an appeal, but the ACAS code suggests this should be given. Doing so might also assist with showing that the request was dealt with in a reasonable manner. Therefore, in short, the employer should ensure that a reasonable process is complied with in the correct time limits when dealing with a flexible working request. Employers should also be aware of issues rejecting requests and potential claims, for instance, an indirect sex discrimination claim if the request was made due to childcare issues. However, as mentioned at the start, the government has announced a plan to make changes to requests for flexible working. The right to request flexible working will become a day one right, but the changes will also impact on the process. For instance, more than one request can be made per year, and the deadline for responding may be reduced. In addition, the intention is that the reasons for rejecting are to be re-evaluated. The plans won't make being able to work flexibly an automatic right, and if there are sound reasons why an employer should reject a request, this will still be possible. However, I said we will keep you updated on these changes. So moving on to my second question, is overtime included in normal working hours for statutory redundancy payments? As you'll be aware, employees who have at least 2 years continuous service are eligible for statutory redundancy payments. The usual calculations for redundancy are based on age, length of service and salary. This then determines the appropriate amount that the employee receives. The figure that is used in terms of salary will be the employee's week's pay, capped at the statutory maximum. However, if the employee earns less than the statutory cap, then this will need to be calculated correctly. So what will be included? If an employee doesn't have normal working hours, then a week's pay will be calculated by the average of all the sums earned in the previous 12 weeks. That would include overtime and commission. If the employee has normal working hours, but the pay varies according to the amount of work done, as with piece work, for instance, or the time of work, such as where the worker's pay is dependent on shift patterns that vary from week to week, their week's pay is, again, based on their average pay during those normal working hours over the previous 12 working weeks. If the employee or worker has normal working hours where the pay does not vary with the amount of work done, they're entitled to the amount which is payable if they work throughout their normal working hours in a week. But the questions then are, what are normal working hours and will they include overtime? In general, for the purposes of redundancy pay, overtime is excluded from the calculation of a week's pay, but not always. The only cases where overtime will be included for the purpose of statutory redundancy payments is where the overtime would be categorised as guaranteed overtime. Please do note that this is different to holiday pay, where voluntary and non-guaranteed overtime would be included. Therefore, assuming your staff do work overtime, you then need to determine which overtime setup applies. In other words, is the overtime that they work guaranteed overtime, or is it voluntary or non-guaranteed? To answer this question, you're then going to need to look at both the overtime arrangements in the contract and what happens in practice. The first place is definitely look at the contract. If a contract states something along the lines of employees will be granted and required to work 5 hours overtime per week, then this would be classed as guaranteed overtime, which then would then be categorised as normal working hours and should therefore be included in the calculation. However, even if your contract makes no reference to anything which could reasonably be interpreted as guaranteed overtime, you still need to consider what happens in practice. As I'm sure we're all very aware, one does not always reflect the other. For example, in the case of Crute and Cape Insulation Company, the employee's contractual hours were 39 hours per week, and there wasn't any reference to guaranteed overtime in the contract. However, he actually worked 60 hours and was paid for a 12-hour day, even if he finished work early and didn't complete the full 12 hours. The tribunal held that the employer felt contractually bound to pay the extra 21 hours per week. As a result, the 21 hours weekly overtime was found to be guaranteed overtime and was part of the employee's normal working hours for the purposes of the redundancy payment. So in summary, the only overtime which will be included in the calculation of a statutory redundancy payment will be guaranteed overtime. And we need to look at both the contract and what happens in practice to decide whether the overtime our employees perform would fall into that definition. So thanks ever so much for listening, and I'll pass you back to David.
Thanks very much to both of you. Very quickly for me, just to make you aware, we continue to work hard to produce and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, blogs, podcasts, videos, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And this includes all episodes of the Q&A sessions. You can also follow the employment team on Twitter at SintonsHR. If you'd like to discuss anything the team have raised today further, contact details on the screen in front of you. Please don't hesitate to get in touch. Our next session will be with us a little bit quicker than normal with Christmas. So next session and last session of 2021 will be with you on Friday, the 17th of December, 10 a.m. on Teams. And as usual, I will send the link round for the session nearer the time. So from all of us, thank you once again for listening. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you in December. Take care.